Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, to be strong, we also need to use our minds, which a lot of people are not using these days. Hello, Kirk. We may have also have JB with us this evening. That's on the chat room.
I'm here. Yes. Good evening.
Yeah, hi. JB, you're pretty good with math, I would expect, as a computer wizard. If you were to compare the odds of death from the coronavirus in the United States, where 565,000 Americans have died of the coronavirus, that's 1.6 in 1,000 is what that is. Almost 2 per 1,000 have died of the coronavirus. Now, Johnson & Johnson's vaccine has just been put on pause by the Biden administration because 6 people out of 7 million got a blood clot. So 6 out of 7 million is how many? What, 1 in a million? Is that... one in about 1.5 million?
Yeah.
And, okay, so your odds of dying from the Johnson & Johnson vaccine are 1 in 1.2 million. And your odds of dying from the coronavirus without it are 1.6 in 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't that by a magnitude of 1,000 to 1,
more
smarter to take the Johnson & Johnson vaccine? Are we expecting that there is a any remedy that is 100% safe? I mean, water will kill you if you have too much of it. How is it that we as Americans have lost the ability to put things in context? Why in the hell would the Biden administration and Fauci put a pause on a vaccine in the midst of all of this when the propensity of a serious side effect is 1 in 1.2 million? I'm just astonished. Is there some other insight here that I'm missing? Because the math seems pretty straightforward to me.
No, it's take the shot.
Well, part of the problem, I guess, is that in America's military institutions like West Point, the 70 cadets were either told to go back and repeat the prior year or booted out of the academy for cheating. So rather than figuring out that 1 in 1,000 is much riskier than 1 in a million, they preferred to cheat. Here's the government paying for their education, And they have this honor code and all of that, and what they decide to do, they decided to cheat. It is truly astonishing. You know, we still have an astounding number of people who are paranoid of a vaccine. Today, I had one of the workmen here at the house say, is the coronavirus real? I mean, in America, it has killed 565,000 people, 10 times the death of Vietnam. And they want to know if it's real. Can you imagine worldwide you have 190 countries battling, and you've got 190 countries as diverse as Mali and Canada, as diverse as Argentina and Austria, all dealing with this. You can look at pictures all around the world of people wearing masks and hospitals being overrun. And you actually think that it's an international government plot to fool people? The folks that are fooled by conspiracy, I mean, you might as well check out because you're way too stupid to function in society. Do you know what number of Americans have been vaccinated? It's an astonishing number of Americans that have received a vaccine. It's almost a quarter of Americans have received two vaccines. So they've received it once and had the second. And almost 40% of Americans have had one or the other vaccines, or one of the two doses of the vaccine. So you're dealing with, 350 million Americans, and you have 40% that have received a vaccine. That's 140 million people. And from 140 million people, the deaths that are rightly or wrongly attributed to the vaccine are under 10. 140. How can you possibly cling to the myth that this vaccine is some kind of a control mechanism, or it's some kind of a tracking mechanism, or it's some kind of a government plot, or it's going to kill you, when 140 million Americans have received a vaccine with no ill effect? Now, one of the things I keep on telling folks is that 100% of those people that are promoting the myth that the vaccine is some tracking mechanism or Bill Gates plot or control mechanism, is that 100% of those people have such meaningless lives that their own mothers wouldn't want to track them, that no one has any interest in what they're doing. I mean, make a difference in this world. Go and pursue something intelligent. Tell people the truth. Show some backbone. Do something worthwhile, and maybe there'll be some people out there that will be interested in tracking your whereabouts. But if you're so stupid to be one of those that is pursuing conspiracies, I can assure you, no one gives a crap. No one.
You know where you are. You're sitting in your mother's basement.
You are. There is no one that would be interested in tracking you, even if it was remotely possible.
That's funny.
You know, one of the things that is just so amazing about conspirators, and you know, I just block them now and email and everything else because they're just a hopeless lot, is that they can promote all of these videos that, you know, somebody said so-and-so, and, you know, and most of them are photoshopped, and they're just stupid. Like, there's one that's being presented right now of French police officers throwing down their handcuffs, and it's being promoted in the conspiracy ranks as the French finally standing up against their government and say they won't arrest anybody who violates COVID protocols. That has nothing to do with COVID. They're throwing down their handcuffs because in this one little community, because the governor of that community said that he would not have any immunity for cops if there was a problem with the arrest. And so those police officers in that little community in France threw down their handcuffs and said, hey, I'm out. I'm not going to arrest somebody if you're going to charge me with a crime.
Yeah.
Now, that has nothing to do with Corona. And so the never odds of the conspiracy ilk go off and say, see, this is proof. And then you have 1,000 likes and hundreds of millions of people saying, see, this is proof we were right. And all they're doing is pursuing rubbish. I mean, it's like swimming in a swamp and saying, yep, there's a turd. I told you there's a turd. Oh, speaking of turds, Dante Wright. I mean, somewhere along the way, if Black Lives doesn't matter, doesn't figure this out, and somebody just starts to think, we're going to realize that they have a serious problem. You know, George Floyd. I mean, it's sad that the man is dead, but the world is no worse off with him being gone. You know, he was a man who pistol whipped a pregnant woman and a robbery because he needed more drugs. This is not a good man. All right. He resisted arrest after committing a criminal act. Should he have been killed? No. And Chapin, the cop who didn't even have the backbone to stand up and speak in his own defense, is a belligerent jerk who will be convicted, and I'm glad, because we have a serious problem with the cops overstepping any reasonable discretion and bounds. But this was a bad man. And now we have Dante Wright, and we have the Minnesotans out rioting again and looting and committing acts of arson and the like, because he was such a good boy and he was taken from us. No, he wasn't. You know why they tried to arrest Dante Wright?
No.
Well, he had an open warrant on for his arrest because he had been indicted and was out on bail for assaulting a woman. He and a buddy of his were late at a party, 2 o'clock in the morning. They said they didn't have enough money for a ride, and they asked if these two women, if they could just stay on the couch in their the living room. The women said, sure, fine. That'll be just fine. So one of them in the middle of the night goes out someplace and comes back with $850 to pay the rent to another, the two women. And one of the women leaves for work. The other woman is about to leave her apartment. And these two jerks, Dante Wright being one of them, stands in the doorway and tells the woman, you know, you either give me the $850, or I'm going to kill you. And she says, no, wait, man, we were just nice to you. And he starts choking her. He says, you either give me the money or, you know, you're dead. He starts beating her up. He steals the money, and he threatens her at gunpoint. That's this charming young man, Dante Wright. Now, there's something tragically wrong in the African-American community that is causing way too many young African-Americans to commit horrible crimes. And then, on top of that, they're not taught to be responsible once they commit the crime, and they blame everyone else for their crime. So when they're arrested, be held accountable for their crimes, they try to resist arrest. So you'll want to know why a disproportionate number of blacks who are being arrested are shot and killed? Because they have committed felonies and they're resisting arrest. You know, don't go and beat up women. Don't, when you do such a thing, don't run away from the cops. Actually show up, honor the conditions of your parole. Don't be carrying around a gun. Don't resist arrest under those circumstances. And guess what? No one's going to shoot you. Not hard to figure out. But with Black Lives Matter having yet another just disgusting reprobate that they're saying, he was such a sweet kid, and they killed him. Listen, the woman who killed him, and she's going to be convicted for manslaughter, and should be. She thought she pulled her taser. She yelled, taser, 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 and then fired, and uh-oh, she says, holy shit, I shot her. She thought she was firing her taser. Now, you don't get
confident.
A, oops, I'm sorry, boo-boo, my mistake, when you kill somebody. If I'm out and I decide that I'm going to tune my radio and I swerve and I run over someone and I kill them in my car, I'm guilty of manslaughter. There's no, oopsie, I'm sorry. She was trained, had a job to do. She was licensed to carry deadly weapons, and she just charged them in a manner that killed someone. No, it wasn't her intent. Most certainly wasn't racism. Had no reason for anybody to be rioting or looting or protesting. And she's going to be convicted of manslaughter. Yeah.
I've handled tasers and I've handled handguns. And if you can't tell one from the other, you're incompetent.
You're incompetent. But, yeah. The triggers look fairly similar. The handles are fairly similar. They're a different color, but you're not looking down at them. And so is it possible? Yeah, it's possible. It's about, one or two a year that this happens among police. But if you're going to give police pistols to shoot and kill people, well, then, they need to be accountable when they shoot and kill people in an unjustified manner, and this was an unjustified manner. Yes, he was trying to flee arrest, but that is not grounds to go shoot him in the stomach. Let him drive away if you can't apprehend him. But nonetheless, there they are. Do you hear about the founder of Black Lives Matter and her real estate purchases?
No, sir.
I think it's 5 multi-million dollar homes that she recently bought. She's like, now, she's an announced communist. And yet with all the fundraising and everything else, she went off and bought 5 multi-million dollar homes. Now, what in the world a communist is doing with 5 multi-million dollar homes? What in the world a person who says they're committed to a cause is doing, spending money that way, is questionable, isn't it? But what it does prove is my point initially, that the founders of Black Lives Matter are Marxists, and that Black Lives Matter is a conspiracy. It is a conspiracy. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with exposing and condemning a conspiracy so long as you're doing so with easily verified. Is that 93% of the time that a black is killed in this country, they're killed by another black. So if you want to say that Black Lives Matter, and they do, you need to be pointing the finger at the African-American community, not anyone else. Now, that said, the police are way out of control in this country, and we have a travesty. And part of it is that police who did terrible things, like Tamir Rice, a 6-year-old kid out playing with a gun, or a 12-year-old kid, somewhere in that range, out playing with a toy gun, and the cop showed up, and 2 seconds later, they shot him dead. And he was not indicted or convicted. So it's time that these cops who are belligerent and who are shoot first and ask questions later are held accountable.
Mm-hmm.
So quite honestly, I hope that Chavez is convicted. I hope he spends the rest of his life behind bars. This woman who committed manslaughter, now she shouldn't. That's probably a 2 to 3 year jail sentence. And the life she took, though, he brought it on himself. But nonetheless, this is a problem in this country. I saw the worst thing that I saw, guys, over this past week took place in Virginia. A big, fat, bald, black police officer holding a pistol as if he just couldn't wait to shoot, has pulled this man over for improper plates. Now, he didn't have improper plates. He had done, it was a brand new car. And so It had dealer plates, not dealer plates. It had the new car plate that you put it back with.
Mm-hmm.
So it was no reason to pull him over. And this cop goes ballistic. This guy inside the car is a fellow black man. He is dressed in his Army uniform. He's a U.S. Army lieutenant. And so this cop pulls the gun on him. Now, there is no reason in those circumstances to pull a gun on somebody. If you pull somebody over because you think they have an improper plate, well, they actually have a fine plate. You do not, under any circumstances, pull a gun on them. Not even think about it. And if you're so belligerent you're going to do that, you ought not be a cop. You ought not have a gun. But nonetheless, he pulled a gun, and he's 3 feet from this man's head, holding the gun right at his head. And he's ordering this man to get out of the car. And the lieutenant is saying, but to get out of the car, I have to lower my hands, which you told me to raise, to unfasten my seatbelt. If I do that, you're going to think that I'm doing something that I shouldn't be done, and you're going to shoot me. So we're not going to do that. And he ends up then pepper spraying this man. It is so dictative of the attitude of cops. It just makes you want to scream.
Yeah.
And this was a black cop doing this to a really articulate, clean-cut man, and happened to be in uniform, driving a very nice car in Virginia at a meaningless traffic stop. I think we got something seriously wrong with our country.
Is any of that related to hiring so many veterans?
Yeah,
in
I think
return?
So. Yeah, I think yeah. so. I think that in the military, we have an all-volunteer military. So those who volunteer like hunting,
want to shoot.
They like guns,
like killing,
and they want to shoot them. They like killing. You know, you don't join the military if you're a pacifist. You don't join the military if you're like me and say, you know, that you use your words, not your fists or your bullets. If you're a person who is saying, well, word wisely wielded is vastly more effective than a fist, knife, or gun, you're not going into the military. You're not going to buy the propaganda. So those who go into the military are naturally predisposed to those things. And the military culture causes them to be enormously dishonest. That was the one thing that the War College of the U.S. proved, is that that's the go-to option amongst the military, is to lie. We shouldn't be surprised, therefore, at the West Point cheating scandal. Now, you get these people who have been trained to kill, indoctrinated to kill, think nothing of killing. And they come back after their tour of duty, and they disproportionately, they don't fit into regular jobs or regular society. So what do? They become cops. And they think that they can take that same attitude to policing. But guess what? The U.S. citizenry isn't the enemy. You know, you can't yell at a U.S. citizen to get down on the ground and spread their arms so that you can handcuff them for doing nothing. And unfortunately, they've been able to get away with that. And yeah, I think it's a serious problem. We've been talking about the belligerence of cops and the fact that the nation has an alphabet soup of policing agencies, from the CIA to the FBI to the firearms, alcohol, and tobacco to Border Patrol to sheriffs, to police. It just goes on and on. And so many layers, both state, regional, city, county, national, that we're just so far out of whack. And we have judges in cahoots with cops that the system is not only badly broken, it was so badly broken 20 years ago when we began to expose and condemn it, that this is now the pushback. And the pushback is long overdue. Now, I see somebody here as a good friend of mine writing, you know, cops are just humans with very difficult jobs, capable of making horrible mistakes. I think it's worse than that. I think it's the attitude that goes with being ex-military and the attitude that goes with being a cop. And there's way too much of this lie on behalf of the brother, never rat him out, plant evidence if you need to. Yeah, and because of the badge, not take any lip from anybody, escalate problems, not de-escalate them, and reach for the gun way too soon. It is a very, very serious problem. We would be so much better off if the overwhelming preponderance of cops were not armed, and you had to be at a very elite position to be armed, so that if you're encountering gunfire, you retreat, you don't engage. And you say, well, you know, that'd be a problem. Well, we got a worse problem now. You know, with every choice you make, there's a reaction. Do something smart, like legalize drugs so that there isn't the motivation to commit most crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And then hold cops accountable for going to the gun first, so they're less likely to do so. And when they go into a community and there is a belligerent person being aggressive towards them, they all have body cams. Let the body cams capture the imagery, retreat, and go back at another time.
Yeah, call them backup.
Yeah, we just can't be doing what we're doing. And people get all fired up. They're chasing after people, high-speed chases, or running after them. And they get way too much adrenaline, and they're making very bad decisions. And it's both the attitude and the training and what goes along when you give people legitimate authority, which is illegitimate on my view, as opposed to earned authority. You earn authority by wielding words wisely, being well-informed, being able to convey a message intelligently.
I read a good quote the other day I thought you would like. It said, violence is the last resort of the incompetent.
Yes, it is.
And I was like, that is a perfect quote. I love that.
Yeah, yeah. If you're resorting to violence, it's because you have no other abilities to respond. And typically what that means is you don't have an argument. You know, it's like 100% of these Nimrods that are out there with their various conspiracies, they only have two retorts. One is to ad hominem, attack me personally, or they attack those who post these shows. A good friend of mine just spent a hellacious week trying to get them just to stand down. I mean, if you have a conspiracy, go someplace else. Just go someplace else. Don't share it. We don't want to know about it. Go someplace else. Wake up, take a cold shower, do something, but just go away. Stop on sites that support this program and this message, promoting your conspiracy, and don't do it mentioning Yahweh or the covenant. So yes, it's either ad hominem, or they want you to go watch a video of some idiot someplace, and that's all they've got. Then God Almighty said, "This is from Exodus, Shemot, Names 3:5. Approach and draw near this place." That's really all God wants. Approach, draw near. Take off your sandals from upon your feet, because this place, which to show the benefits of the relationship that you are standing upon, it is set apart in special ground. So you know, we were talking to, in the program last week. We've got to say that because he didn't like sandals. I don't think so. In fact, what does God say about Pesach? When you eat Pesach, doesn't he explicitly say, I want your laces tied on your sandals, and I want you girded around the waist, standing upright, staff in hand, ready to go?
Yeah.
So do you think God's got a thing against sandals? There's something about taking off your shoes, going to someone's home. This is God's office now. This is the top of Mount Horeb. Yeah, taking off your shoes and getting comfortable. You know, come on, take off your shoes and sit down. Let's have a chat. You're less likely to be impatient and run away as well. He said, I am God, the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Yishak, and the God of Jacob. What that basically means, I'm the God of the covenant. I'm the God of laughter. I'm the God of Israel. And that's rather important because God did not say that he was the God of the Roman Catholics, of the Gentile Christians, or of the Talmudic Jews. I'm the God of Abraham, God of Yishak, the God of Jacob. Would either of those three gentlemen be known to us outside of the Torah?
Not at all.
No. In the Talmud, takes Torah stories and embellishes them. The Quran takes Torah stories and bastardizes them. But no, none of those three people would even be known. I am the God of the Torah relationships. But Moshe concealed his face because he was awestruck from looking at the Almighty. Now, it's hard to judge Moshe on this. I mean, I would like to think that we would all bask in this, that we would be smiles from ear to ear, that our eyes would be as open as saucers, that we would just want to go and embrace the Lord. That's what I would think. But, you know, we're not in that scene. We don't know what it was like to walk up with your sheep, minding your own business, and all of a sudden to see the entire top of the mountain ablaze. And you walk up there, and then you hear God talking to you. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't know how bright it
we
was.
We know
how
Yahweh. Moshe didn't know him at that time.
No.
That's also true. That's also true.
We know, Yahweh, we know he would want us to look on him and come be with him. Moshe's going, okay, what's up here?
Oh, my. Oh, my.
Yeah, oh, my. Yeah, he didn't know. He did not know Yahweh. And we do. That's probably why I would say that I would like to think that in that circumstance, that we would say, hey, Dad, oh, it's good to see
wow.
you.
Wow, get up.
Yes. Oh, wow. Let's say this is in the chat room, BB, about CW spreading lies that Jews are God's people, that they were really trying to take over the world. SOS crap. He got himself blocked by me. I don't know what this this person is trying to say. But if this individual...
Fred Snell messaged them the other day, is what they said earlier.
So, all right, so this is not...
That you were spreading lies.
Oh, okay. All right, I got it now. Fred Snell is one of the most lost souls that we have encountered along the way. He has become a raging anti-Semite and is about the conspiracy that Jews aren't Jews. And that, I guess, DNA doesn't matter because the J1 apple, from his point of view, doesn't matter. So all she's doing is she's parroting what a conspiracy idiot has to say. Listen, I spend a lot of time talking about conspiracy because, unfortunately, a lot of people, I think it's the fastest growing religion in the world, are conspiratorial. Today, the most prevalent conspiracy is the anti-vaxxers, the vax hysteria. And it's all lies. The longest living conspiracy is the one that Fred Snell is promoting, which is blame the Jews. I've read what he wrote years ago, and it's vomit. And so it's just so much of it out there. I think it's in the range of 40% of Americans are conspiratorial. We've dumbed ourselves down where we can't think anymore. And so that's the reason we talk about it. Yahweh says, don't go there. It's a credibility sinkhole. And it's essentially religious. It does not matter the amount of evidence or reason that you bring against the conspiracy, whether it be chemtrails or the false flags or the flat earth or vax hysteria. It doesn't matter. That you
have a
you
great
can
peril for
prove
to just go into
that
it and
that,
just love
that
it.
Their mythology has no basis in fact. They just continue to believe it. I remember this guy that was harassing Steve on his presentation of my shows because he really got into anti-vax. He was harassing me with emails on how Trump had all of this under control, that the U.S. military was going to step in, that Trump had really won the election, and that he would not be unseated, and that Biden had this secret about him so that he would never become president. It went on and on in great detail about what was about to happen. And I just kept track of all the claims he made, and I sent it back to him. I said, so none of what you said is true. When are you going to stop believing this stuff? Is any amount of proof that this legacy of things that you claimed were true and none of it happened enough to convince you that you're wrong and you shouldn't trust the people who said these things? And, of course, what you get is just more of it. So
yeah,
we speak a lot about conspiracy because we're so – and God is so opposed to them.
Mm-hmm.
So Moshe concealed his face because he was awestruck, looking at the Almighty. Now, if the entire rocky height of this barren mountain, Mount Chorob, was ablaze in brilliant light, it would be nigh on impossible to stare directly into the face of God. If it were a puny burning bush, I don't think that Moshe is putting his head between his knees and saying, I can't handle it. So I'm going to say that's a very strong point in favor of the top of the mountain. Of course, the very fact that what God says next, that is not next, but very soon, about you want some proof that I'm going to do what I said I'm going to do, you're going to come right back here and I'm going to give you the Torah. This is going to go full circle right back to the same place. Well, guess what? He didn't come back to a burning bush. So I don't know how people missed the top of the mountain was a fire versus a bush, but nonetheless they have. Then Yahweh said, I have witnessed and surely seen the oppression and persecution, the owning, the affliction and suffering, the harassment, poverty, misery, and humiliation of my people who are in the crucibles of oppression, drain, the cauldrons of religious and governmental, military and economic subjugation, the coercions and cruelty experienced within Egypt, where the people were confined and restricted by religious and political persecution. Mitzrayim is the plural of Matzor, which means to be delineated as a foe and besieged during a time of testing and tribulation. Matzor, in turn, is from Sur, which means to be bound and confined by an adversary, besieged, assaulted, and shut up, and enclosed as if in a concentration camp by those showing great hostility. Sur is the word that Yahweh uses to describe the time of Jacob's troubles. It's sore. Now, the reason I bring all this up is that God said that he saw the owning. When he goes about presenting Pesach, he says that what Pesach was conceived to resolve is the owning. Oppression and persecution, affliction and suffering, harassment, poverty, misery, humiliation. Well, that should strike people as such that is not an individual sin. You know, stealing somebody's bubble gum, that's an individual sin. A country afflicting its citizens, or a continent, like under Roman Catholicism, subjecting the serfs to slavery. You know, that's oppression. That's affliction. That's poverty and harassment. The Mitzrayim, the Egyptians, subjecting hundreds of thousands of Jews to forced labor and slavery, afflicting them, harassing them, impoverishing them, humiliating them. That's the result. There's only two things that can do that. It's the result of one or two things, or both: religion and politics. And therefore, since Pesach, which is collaborative with matzah, by God's own definition, was specifically designed to liberate people from Oni, God's made this very clear, that what he is liberating us from is religion and politics. Those are the great foes of humankind. And we saw them red in tooth and claw in Mitzrayim. He said, I have heard their cry of distress because the presence of their oppressive taskmasters who are exploiting them, the Nagas, which are tyrannical rulers who are manipulating and cruelly abusing them. Once again, if you have oppressive taskmasters who are exploiting them, you have to have a governmental system that allows it, that encourages it, like the feudal system throughout Europe, like the caste system in India, like the caste that systems that were pervasive in every civilization around the world. So you have to have a political system that supports it, and no political system has any degree of longevity unless it's inoculated with religion, unless the religion and the politics of the land are one. And so God is again saying, I have seen them being abused by religious and political taskmasters. Is it possible that there is economic taskmasters and military taskmasters? Yes. But again, the only way that you can have an economic taskmaster or a military taskmaster who is exploiting is to have a government and a religion that can
control them. System.
Yep. Yeah. So it's important for us to recognize that Christianity has it all wrong. In Christianity, the sin that they think needs to be forgiven, that we need to confess our individual sins. God doesn't give a hoot. You know, it's just like the government doesn't want to track a loser. The government does not care that, you know, you told a lie about Susie Q. That's not what God is after here. It's pervasive crimes against humanity that are perpetrated by religious and political institutions. Because I recognize and I personally know their pain and suffering, macabre, their sorrow, their grief, their emotional and mental anguish, their physical pain. And this, again, is the problem of group think versus individual. Most individuals, and now there's one in a million, individuals who individually will kidnap somebody and abuse them, harass them, kidnap them, and lock them up and torment them. That's about one in a million people. You know, in America at this point, there may be 350, 400 people that are so inclined. Very few and far between. But collectively in institutions, it's very pervasive. We institutionally have a propensity to abuse people. So, again, the pain and suffering that was being inflicted was because the Egyptians, based on their religion and based on their politics and based upon their military and their overall patriotism and attitude, went along with the abuse. You know, and Nazi Germany the reason that so many people were caught up in it is gang mentality is exceedingly effective at causing people mm-hmm. to lose their ability to be moral. That's what happened in Egypt. The people were victims because they allowed themselves to be victims. And this, as we study civilizations of nations, what we find is that almost all civilizations are counterproductive. It's people in civilizations that go out with armies to rob, to enslave, to control other people, and they use their military might to control their own people. There is no history of a nation that is devoted to the liberation of people both at home and abroad, the enrichment of people both at home and abroad. Of course, based on this, we now know why Yahweh chose Moshe. He was the only man on the planet who had witnessed what Yahweh had seen and agreed with God's assessment. He was it. Now, he was a lone individual now and not part of the gang, the cult. There would be a lot that Yahweh would have to teach Moshe for him to prevail. And, of course, he did that in revealing the Torah. But there was one subject in which their abhorrence was shared. And I don't think God really likes having to berate his people over their propensity to be religious and political, their rebellion against him, their arrogance, their stubbornness. I don't think God likes it at all. And so if he can work with somebody that he doesn't need to go into that, that they know because they've had experience either with the military or with politics or with religion, and they just know, then he can spend all the time talking about the stuff that he enjoys, which is the benefits of his Torah and his covenant, his testimony, and of listening to it. And I think that's, to a large degree, why Moshe was picked. Of course, Moshe has other qualifications that God liked. And one of them was that Moshe was not very articulate. Now, his speeches in Devarim are brilliant. So reliant, Moshe became, you know, an amazing troubadour. But I think God likes people, as my wife would tell me all the time, that I butcher every foreign language. And I probably even butcher English and turn it into a foreign language. But that's the fact is that God likes that. He's not looking for that kind of perfection. He's looking for commitment. He's looking for somebody with a backbone, too. Like what happened when Moshe saw one of these taskmasters attacking one of his people? He stood in the way.
Yeah. He killed him.
He killed him. He took the risk to protect an innocent person. That's a man of character. And, we don't have many justifications for killing, but stopping a person from killing another innocent person, if your intent isn't to kill, your intent is to protect, that happens to be one of the examples. Yahweh was, as throughout this, been rolling out some of the most telling words in the Hebrew vocabulary to convey his dismay with the consequence of human oppression and persecution. And there is no human oppression and persecution that does not flow from governments, religions, or militaries. That's it. So when God is speaking against oppression and persecution, he is speaking against the political and religious establishment. God is aware of the pain and anguish his people were suffering because he would take it all upon himself and he would endure the consequence. He experienced the worst man could inflict during Pesach and Matzah. And he took the most horrid aspects of religion and political affliction and persecution with him into Sheol on yeasted bread. Oh, God is, in fact, very aware of this. He says, so I have descended. I've come down and have diminished an aspect of myself to deliver them. La Natsal, to defend and spare them, rescue and saving them by snatching them away from the influence of the Mitzrayim, the crucibles of political and religious oppression, and to lift them out of that land to a good land, a spacious land, flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Yabusi. So what God is telling us is something we've talked about a lot, but the religious seem to miss. They want the God of the Old Testament to be onerous. They want him to have laws which have to be obeyed. They want people to feel like they must submit to him and be afraid of him. And yet, the God who inspired these books and this message said just the opposite. I have descended to deliver them from having to obey others, from being submissive, for being persecuted, rather than to put them under these circumstances so they're obedient. No, I did just the opposite. I descended to deliver them, to lift them out of the places of oppression and persecution, to a land that is spacious, open, free, roomy, agreeable. That's what the word rakab means. Milk and honey. Milk is synonymous with being nurturing. Honey is synonymous with both being sweet, therefore pleasant, but also with longevity. And these are the peoples that currently lived in that place, the Canaanite, which means those who will be subdued, the Hittite, is the shattered and broken, the Perizzite is the overtly open, and the Amorite is the boastful, why the Chiwi is really the instead of Hivite, it's C-H-I-W-Y, is the declarative, and the Yabusi is the rejected and tread upon. It was to become a rescue mission. Yahweh was motivated and committed to lifting his people out of man's oppressive religious and political. God was offering to take them to a very good place. That's what parents do for their children. If your child is in a bad place, a parent goes in, removes them from that place, and takes them to a better place. What follows is repeated three times. A rescue, no matter how grand, is irrelevant unless the beneficiary understands their plight. And if you don't understand that you're in harm's way, if you don't understand the purpose of the rescue, if you don't know what the alternative is to, for example, being enslaved, then you're likely to fall back into the behavior that has become, you've become accustomed to. So it's really important that we understand exactly what God is saving his people from, what he is rescuing them from. He repeats it three times because he wants us to pay attention and appreciate exactly what it is that he was liberating the children of Israel from. God's point is that human, political, and religious dreams are predicated upon placing burdens on their subjects. They're all works-based, making them oppressive and suppressive. Yahweh's solution, which is liberating and uplifting and free, is the antithesis of man's program. So this is Shemot Names, Exodus 3:10. And so now at this time, it is my desire that you choose to go, electing to walk as an expression of my will. Halak, let's go. It was written in the call, imperative, paragogic, cohortative. Oh, sounds like a lot of grammar gibberish, but call establishes a genuine relationship between the speaker in this case Yahweh, and the subject, in this case, his children. The imperative is second person volition. So in this case, it is the person being spoken to. I mean, the people being spoken to have a choice in this matter. The paragogic is a means of emphasis, of being emphatic, particularly as something that has both a logical and an emotional appeal. And the cohortative is first-person volition. That means it's the choice, the will, the desire of the speaker. So our choice is here, we can just ignore all of that and just say, and so now at this time, walk. That would be wa'ata halak. And now at this time, walk. Or you can consider why this was written in the call imperative, paragogic, cohortative, and say, and so now at this time, it is my desire that you choose to go, electing to walk as an expression of divine will. Now, the reason that's important is that once you come to know Yahweh, the next thing on our agenda should be, what does God want? Right? What does God want?
Yeah.
We should be curious in what he's offering to see if we like it. But the most important is, what does he want? Because you're not going to get to know him. You're not going to endear yourself to him. You're not going to enjoy what he's offering unless you know what he wants. Well, God is saying what he wants. When the religious say, you know, I'm searching for God's will for my life.
Will for my life.
Read the daggone book. It's Yahweh's will that you choose to walk in a manner that is consistent with his desire. And what was that? It was to walk away from religion and politics, wasn't it? So it's God's desire, his will for your life is to walk away from the influence of religion and politics. And may I add a third and fourth, patriotism and conspiracy.
Hear, hear.
That I will send you out, I am dispatching and extending you, sending you off. This is now he's speaking to Moshe. I will send you out to Pharaoh, which means great house, to bring out my people. By the way, Pharaoh is written as Pharaoh in the Hebrew text written 1450 BCE, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mike sent me an article the other day, and he was even disgusted by it. They found an example of an alphabet. It has a lot of elements of Hebrew, some elements of Egyptian in it, dating to about 1400 BCE. They found it in Israel. But I think it's the oldest example of an alphabet found anywhere in the world. And so these idiots say, well, it's proof that the alphabet of the Hebrews came from Egypt and was brought here. Now, of course, the alphabet wasn't hieroglyphic. It was a real alphabet. And they, nonetheless, you can't give any credit to God or his people, I guess, and maintain your job in academia. So we will say anything that we possibly can. So I'll send you out to Pharaoh to bring out my people. Fred, are you listening? The children of Israel. Who's his people? Well, according to God, it's the children
Israel
of Israel.
Yehuda.
Yeah, I had one of the guys working for us today thought that he was a black Hebrew Israelite. And Leah, God bless her, she said, go take a spit test. If you don't have J1 genetics, you weren't a Jew. It's as simple as that. Go take a spit test. He says, I'm looking at you. You're not a Jew. So, yeah, and that's not a crime. You know?
No.
Heck, I'm not a Jew.
No.
I wish I was, but I'm not. Actually, I don't wish I was because there's so many prophecies about a foreigner who is
they're
going to
have responsibilities.
Yeah, so I'm delighted that I'm actually not. But one of the things, like I was reading and translating in Pesach, it says that, you know, there's a foreigner who's visiting in your land and is gathering together with you, and then that foreigner wants to celebrate Pesach. He's welcome to do so long as the way that he does it is consistent with all of the inscribed written instructions that I have provided and the means to resolve the dispute and execute good judgment. And so the prerequisite was gathering together with Israel. Gathering together with Israel. Living, whether it's in person or from your perspective and attitude, with Israel, which means anti-Semites are not welcome. If you're an anti-Semite, you cannot benefit from Passover. So now at this time, it is my desire that you choose to go, electing to walk as an expression of my will. I will send you out to Pharaoh to bring out my people, the children of Israel, Bene Israel, sons who engage and endure with God, from always over and over and over again, from the crucibles of oppression, Mitzrayim. Right. Mitzrayim speaks of oppression, of subjugation, of persecution, of religious and military coercion, of cruelty experienced on a broad scale, where people are restricted and persecuted. What do you think the likelihood would have been for the Polish people to have created concentration camps like Auschwitz if it had not been under the authority of the occupying Nazis?
Impossible.
Yeah, impossible. Now, were the Poles less zealous about protecting Jews than they should have been? Damn straight.
Sure.
But it was done because it was a national governmental mandate of the occupying force and the Nazis. That's what
fear.
Kind of oppression that Mitzrayim is exposing. That's why God constantly says, I'm sending you to bring out my people, to Yatzah, to free my people from Mitzrayim, the crucibles of religious and political oppression. Now, in Hebrew, moods can speak volumes. This is one of the rare occasions where, as we spoke just a moment ago, a verb is subject to volition in the first and second person. You know, the cohortative and the imperative reveal that while the mission was subject to free will, meaning that Moshe was given the choice, not an order, it was also conveyed as the desire of God. God is saying, I really want you to do this. But it's your choice, but I really want you to do this. I wish we had these moods in English. It would make things so much easier, so much easier to comprehend the spirit of and tone of a request in a language that has the means to convey volition in first, second, and third person. That's a rich language. I can, of course, I think we all can, empathize with Moshe. I've often asked the same question regarding in my role in sharing what God revealed through his prophets, through Moshe in particular. But Moshe said to the Almighty, who am I? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and actually bring out the children of Israel from the crucible of Egypt? Indeed. Do you think the Dodes said, hey, yeah, who am I? The shepherd down there in Bethlehem, who am I? Yirmiyah said, yeah, who am I? Moshe said, who am I? Even Abraham said, who am I? that you should be doing this. And I think that's the response that God wants. Because, you know, we've laughed about this many times. God doesn't choose the best and the brightest. You know, to be chosen to work with Yah. Now, I'm going to give Moshe some credit. I think Moshe is a cool dude. I respect him. I really
he can develop
respect
talent,
him.
Though.
Oh, yeah, and I respect Doat, no question about it. So, you know, God's got a nose for talent. There's no question about it. But the people he chooses, well, this was an 80-year-old, broken down, out of work, former government official that was on the lam for having killed somebody. You know, that's not exactly going to the top of the pecking order and say, you know, I'm going to get the most celebrated cleric.
Every recruiter
king,
missed that one. Yeah,
it's the recruiter's just, yeah, the headhunter not going to say, yeah, I think Moshe is the guy. Yeah, 80 years old, he's tending sheep. And if you ever looked at the pictures around Mount Horeb in Arabia, if you're tending sheep there, you're down on your luck. If anybody should have been a conspiratorial guy, it should have been Moshe. He was living in a backwater place. I guess he wasn't in his mom's basement. It was in his mother-in-law's basement, I guess. But Moshe said to the Almighty, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and actually bring out the children of Israel from the crucible of Egypt? At the time, it is likely that Egypt was the most powerful country in the world. You know, you could say Assyria. Babylon really wasn't established at that time. The Hittites were somewhat strong. But the Egyptians were the powerhouse.
Oh, yeah.
And so it would be, yeah, it'd be like having somebody from Botswana. And God say to the guy that's you know, tilling his garden with a plow or tending sheep at Botswana, I want you to go to America and bring out the 7 million Jews. And, oh, by the way,
go talk to the president.
Yeah, go talk to the president and get him to agree. And you know, this guy's going to say, oh, come on. I'm not qualified for this job. Please find someone else. You know, based on his birth and his life, Moshe was actually the most qualified person to perform this mission. Well, if you overlook the fact that he was really old, had a speech impediment, and was an alleged murderer.
Didn't want the job.
With a death sentence hanging over his head.
Yeah, other than that.
You know, alone he may have been inconsequential compared to the power and influence of Egypt. By himself, or even with the whole Midian army, Moshe recognized that he was wholly inadequate. Yeah, he could have taken the Hittite army, the Midian army, everybody else in the region, and gone at the head of all that mighty army, and they'd have just been slaughtered going into Egypt. But yet, what was he going to use? God's way. I'm not going to use bullets and bombs. We're going to use our words. And when words don't work, we're going to use symbols. And we'll see if we can get their attention. So by himself, or even with the entire Midian army, Moshe recognized that he was wholly inadequate. And it is this accurate self-assessment, along with his appreciation for the plight of his people, which made him an ideal implement. You have to have some empathy. You know, Arsberger's is probably not a common trait among Yah's prophets. He's probably not into psychopaths or narcissists. You have to have empathy. And one of the ways that you develop empathy is to have failed.
Mm.
How would you know about a broken family if you didn't experience a broken family? How would you know about heartache, what God was enduring on behalf of his people, if you hadn't experienced the pain of loss and sadness and seeing these hellish conditions? So empathy is a really important characteristic, particularly if you're going to try to align your thinking with Yahweh. You need to feel what he feels, to think what he thinks, to be passionate about what's important to him. And sometimes it's complicated. Yahweh made a promise to Abraham, to Yitzhak, and to Jacob that he was going to rescue his people, not once, but multiple times. He has made a promise that he is going to rescue them at the end, that there will be a remnant of Israelites and Yahudim, that Dod is going to come in the end on Yom Kippurim in 2033, and he's going to rescue. So we're going to have a second Exodus. God has made this commitment, and yet he's exceedingly disappointed in his people. So it's this very complicated thing where people in Egypt, they weren't exactly endearing themselves to God. They did a lot of stuff that was really horrible. They weren't a pretty scene. And yet God made a commitment. He was going to honor it. And even as we do this show, even as we write these books and prepare these books and edit them and do all the work that we are putting them online that we are collectively doing as a family, we're doing it for some people that sometimes are hard to love. And when we say that, we're really embracing Yahweh's perspective. He loves them. And he committed to save them, and he's committed to doing it again. And he wants his people to wake up and listen. But, oh, my, this is a stubborn group that was going to be very, yeah, very difficult to work with, you know. So it's important for those who are listening to know. There are lots of scholars and theologians that are slightly better educated to perform this mission. You know, that have PhDs in theological studies or in ancient languages. But God's not using any of them. And it's for one or two reasons. Either they had no interest in doing this, or that they thought that that because of their skills they could be self-reliant, or they chose not to engage because it would have been catastrophic for their careers. You know, standing up for Yahweh against religious and academic communities is not something that an academic is going to want to do. Now, we, on the other hand,
can you point out something?
Yeah.
As you're talking here, while you were talking, when you were discussing the other verse and you went into all the grammar, I pulled out my little grammar chart, which I keep handy. Everything with the cohortive and the, and you know, whatever, paragraph, is all easily stated there. You have to take some big notes and look them all up and get that.
Yeah, you do.
And everything was totally accurate. It was better written. I'm looking at the same time in parallel English Bibles where they've missed all that, and those are the scholars.
Yes.
So, you know, yeah, there's a lot of people there, but they won't go the extra mile. They won't delve into it, and they won't go where the words lead. They won't use what's easily at your disposal. I'm getting them from the books of these people, right? The grammar books.
Right.
So,
right.
And but they don't write. They don't use it to explain what God said. So
they're fully capable
they're
of looking up the call stem or the hiphol or the niffle or they can look up the stem. Right.
Imperative.
And understand
the expressive
that. They
part
can,
of paragogic.
Right. Yeah, they can look up the conjugations. They can look up the moods. You know, there's some really interesting
things. Every dictionary, lexicon, everything we use is compiled by these same religious people. It's not like we went
and they don't use it.
We're using their material and proving their translations wrong.
Yeah, as Kirk said, it takes a lot of work because when you're translating a word, the worst thing you can do is go to Strong's and say, well, that's the definition of Strong's is this, and then they're and just run with it. because most of Strong's definitions were created to justify the King James. And so what you have to do is you have to realize, okay, the text was written without diacritical markings. So you need to look at every word that is written with the same set of letters. Mm-hmm. And because it could be any one of those words, which word written with the same set of letters best fits this definition.
Best fits the context.
And then you need to look at the actionable root. What does the actionable root of this word, how does it shape it? And then you look at related words, words First which step. Are, mm-hmm. it's like if a word has a feminine or masculine ending, and you're looking up, it's feminine, and you're looking up the masculine version of it, the counterpart. Well, you can get other shadings from it. And then you have to look at the context. And so there's a lot goes into it. And you just can't say, go to one source. And we will typically search 5, 10, sometimes 15 different sources. And what I find is that when you're dealing with a word that's not used a lot, there's only one safe way to go. And that safe way to go is to look how the word is initially introduced.
First
and
use.
Then maybe, yes, and then 4 or 5 other subsequent uses. And if the definition that is chosen for it, chalal, for example, which is almost universally translated, bow down and worship, and you look at its use, and it's impossible to render it that way. And in fact, in all of its initial uses in the Torah, it isn't translated that way because it's dealing between people, and there is no possibility whatsoever. In fact, the context actually precludes you from those kind of definitions. And the other thing is something that we have learned here recently, which is that there are a host of words that are compound words. Mikra is a wonderful example. It is a compound of my, which is an interrogative that encourages us to think about the who, the what, the why, the where, and the how of something, and kara, which means to be invited, to be called out, to read and recite, to be welcomed and to meet. And so we should ask ourselves all of the pertinent questions about being invited and summoned to be welcomed into God's company. So there's a lot of words that are a compound of those things. Mishpat, for example, again, the me, which is the interrogative, and shafat, which means to make an informed and rational decision about the means to either condemn or to exonerate. So there are – it's work. I'm rewriting the final of the Pesach chapters. There were a couple of introductory chapters that brought us up to Pesach, and now I'm rewriting the second of the Pesach chapter. And I've been working on it now for a little over a week, and I'm on page like 31. And you would say, oh, my God, are you slow. But I'm going back in, and I'm redoing every translation. And, you know, and it takes time because you really need to be careful and think of the word order and the moods and the conjugations and the roots and the like. And, you know, and you don't want to get it wrong. Pesach is life and death, literally. So you want to get it right. And then you find out when you do improve it that the commentary needs to be very different than when you wrote in the past. So it to be thoughtful it's a work of love. You need to be devoted to it.
Multiple sources. Yeah, I actually have my translation set up and logos pulled up at the moment. I counted that. I currently have 21 open tabs between different dictionaries, lexicons, grammar books, et cetera.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I do the same thing. And you probably
have counting what I have in physical and what I have in other things.
Right. And you probably also have some interlinears that are set up that kind of give you a word's eye view of the grammar and the order of things. And there's a lot that goes into it.
Uh-huh.
It's fun, but it's not fast. In fact, one of the things that Yahweh actually says about Moshe is that during that argument where Aaron and Miriam got too full for their britches, and they said, hey, you know, well, who's to say that Moshe is the only person that God is speaking through? You know, they wanted to, you know, have more limelight and stand
what
above
about
Moshe. Yeah, and, you know, and God did not take that well. You know, he had a timeout meeting where they went to the tent of the witness, and he went and said, you know, there is something really different about Moshe. And he has a number of things that he says, but one of the things that he said about Moshe is very intriguing, which is that with most prophets, I will speak to them in a manner that is perplexing, that has riddles. But with Moshe, I was very plain and forthright. And you might say, well, why wouldn't God just be straightforward and forthright in everything he says? Because Moshe is the one person, he says, I never spoke about an enigma. I didn't use parables with him. It just was a matter of fact. Well, he's establishing the relationship. He's talking about the creation of the universe, of our planet, of life, of the ensuing covenant relationship, and its terms and conditions, and the liberation of his people, and the journey into the promised land. These were very concrete events in history, and God was very blunt. Just going to lay it out. Here it is. But so much of what God said, he did not convey it that way. And that's one of the things that was unique about Moshe. He said, the other prophets, I will speak in riddles and enigmas. And the reason is that if you're not willing to invest the time like JB and Kirk, like you guys are doing, mm-hmm. then you're not going to know. And he doesn't want you to know from because it's easy. If you tell somebody and somebody asks, well, what do I need to get into heaven? And you give them, well, here's the five terms and conditions. And they say, okay, I can do that. But none of them resonate. They don't know why God asked for any of them. And all they're trying to do is get in and then go about their daily lives. Well, that's not what God's interested in. He's interested in people who are devoted to learning who he is, what he wants, and what he's offering in return. And to do that, it is a labor of love, but it's an enormous investment of time. And I will tell you that the thing that drives me are the insights, that the things that you realize when you're investigating his word that maybe no one has seen in 1,000, 2,000 years, sometimes 3,000 years. And that is exciting. And if he didn't write in a manner that had some riddles to be solved and some enigmas to be unwrapped, you would never have that thrill. And so there is a thrill of discovery.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't wait to share it. And if God didn't speak that way, then he would have no filter mechanism of keeping the unwanted out of heaven, and be no thrill for us as we search his word. But that's the fun of it.
Hmm.
So they were, you know, if you're talking about people, why they chose not to go, you and I, both, all three of us said, yeah, we'll do this. You know, so long as Yahweh promises to work with us, is shield our family from the wrath that this mission engenders from time to time, why not? I mean, you've got the opportunity to work with the creator of the universe. He's the easiest boss in the world. We have a tendency to drive ourselves because of our passion for it, but he's just easy. He's fun to be with and is not judgmental, very uplifting, supportive, makes it fun.
Why don't people want to be free? I mean, that's what we've been talking about the whole time today, is they don't want to be free.
I know.
What is the
problem
there?
It's scary for them. It's scary. It's like the whole COVID shutdowns. You know, it's one thing about the people who are anti-vax that I do understand. The government has been disingenuous. The government never should have locked people down.
Scared them.
The fear porn was
horrible.
It's not
a conspiracy to say that the government took advantage of this situation.
Correct.
To expand itself.
Yes. To control the economy, people's livelihoods, and to control people's freedoms, to deprive them of freedom. Those were devastating things that they did. And so I can understand why you wouldn't trust your government. I don't trust the government. But to go from I don't trust my government to I'm not going to take a vaccine, well, that's just a leap too far. So
just
because you don't trust your government doesn't mean that your government is trying to control you or track you with a
you won't be a pod person.
A
the one I heard the other day, I got pinned down at work by a conspiracy theorist, was that with this is all setting up for the next virus, and those who get the vaccine, they're vaccinated for the next virus because they're willing to go along with control, and those who don't get it, they'll die from the next virus.
Okay, well then if that were the case, would you get the vaccine? I mean, excuse me, if that were the case, wouldn't you get the vaccine? Come on, think it through, people. Oh,
I just sat there, nodded, and smiled. I wasn't going to bother trying to engage this guy.
You know, yeah, they're like talking to a religious person.
It is a religious person.
Yeah. Can I go now?
Yeah, can I go? So then he responded. This is what Yahweh said. Then he responded. Indeed, I will be with you.
Yay.
Wa'amar. He promised. Indeed, he assured, I will be, Ihaya. I was, I am, and I always will be. Called him perfect. Genuinely, actually, consistently, continually, be, Haya, exist, am, with, Ata, you. That is the coolest thing about God. You get to work with him. You don't work under him. You don't work for him. You don't obey him. You work with him. That's what God's whole thing is. He wants to work with us. It's a lovely, lovely opportunity, and it's an amazing thing that people think that you need to be serving him or obeying him. What does he say here? So then God responded. So then he responded and said, indeed, I will be with you. M means alongside, associated, interactive, in a relationship near you.
I never feel God's presence in my life more than when I'm sitting there translating.
Of course. We all do. Yes.
Right there. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I, of course, can't help but laugh. Even in this most telling of passages, Yahweh has inserted something that I find funny, especially in light of my personal inadequacies. While the primary meaning of M is with, alongside, near, and associated in an interactive relationship, you know that M also means that I will be there in spite of you. I take to mean
despite
that
all that.
God will complete his mission in spite of our inadequacy. It's something that we've all long known. It's but to see it in writing, I think is wonderful.
Killing.
Yeah.
God's
not expecting a lot from us. Yahweh prefers to do things, even the big things, with us, through us, rather than alone. Sure. He could have blasted the Egyptians. He could have paved a yellow brick road for his people to follow home. Heck, he could have put them on a 747 and flown them all out of a lot of 747s and flown them all out of Egypt. He could have done a magic carpet. But no, that's not his way. He wants to go explore, to take long walks, to camp out, to have long chats, for us to him to teach us to learn, reveal with words and signs, and to find out how reliant we're able to be, and do we want to work together? That's God's style. So he wasn't about to go into Egypt alone. He chose to go with a broken down, stuttering 80-year-old shepherd. God's style. I like it. And then he said, and this is your sign, that indeed I myself have sent you. When you come out, Yahzah, with the people from the crucibles of Egyptian oppression, by the way, that's also a big thing, right? I mean, he's already said a lot. He's just said that people who have no weapons, who have no clout, who have no influence, who have been subjugated as slaves for 400 years, are coming out with you. That the Egyptians are going to let them go, and you're going to bring them, yeah, with you. That's already saying a lot. So when you come out, yeah, with the people from the crucibles of Egyptian oppression, you will work with them and God upon this specific mountain.
Cool.
Full circle.
Really?
Full circle. It's just like we began our relationship with God in the Garden of Eden, and in a matter of now a dozen years, we're going to return to the Garden of Eden. The seven steps that we take to God bring us right back home. And in this particular case, God revealed himself to Moshe on Mount Horeb, and he revealed himself to all humankind in exactly this same place. It's just like Yahweh confirmed the covenant, providing the Pesach lamb with Abraham and Yitzhak on Mount Moriah, and 40 obel later, he himself was the Passover lamb on Mount Moriah. And 40 obel thereafter, he's returning to Dod to establish his home and Dod's home on that same mountain. It all comes full circle. I'm telling you what happened because it's what will happen. And so there's two aspects of this that are so important. The mountain of God upon this specific mountain is precisely what happened. Moshe, with a considerable assist from God, led his people out of Egypt directly across the Red Sea into Arabia and back to Mount Horeb. Having returned to this place, Moshe continued to work with Yahweh. Together, they would reveal and share God's Torah teaching and guidance with all humankind. If it wasn't for the fact that God retrieved his people and then on this same place revealed the Torah, we would have no way of knowing him. We'd have no way of engaging in a relationship with him. We wouldn't understand how Pesach opens the door to Yahweh's home and Matzah perfects us so that we can enter and enjoy Bikurim, where we're adopted into his family, so that we can enjoy Shabuah, being enriched and empowered by God. We would have had no clue what any of these things represent. We wouldn't understand that there were five benefits and five conditions of the covenant. We wouldn't know Yahweh's name. So this is the most important mission that was ever undertaken. And here's Yahweh saying, when you come up with my people from the crucibles of Egyptian oppression, you will work with God upon this very mountain. And as a result, we have the Torah. Well, fellas, that's actually the end of the first chapter of volume 4 of Yada Yah. It's a good place for us to stop, and we will
perfect ending.
Begin
yes,
the
no,
next
great.
Chapter. Yeah, it's it's the preamble, and that's what this is. This is this volume is called Mikra. It's the either be the first three or the first four Mikra will be in this volume. And the last either three or four will be in the next volume, which we call Moed, likelihood, is that the preamble to Pesach is essential because God is constantly saying that Pesach and Matzah are a collaborative event that was designed to liberate and rescue and free us from human religious and political oppression. And unless you really understand how that transpired, what God said and what he did and how that occurred, you really are not in a position to understand Passover, much less Matzah. As a matter of fact, when you get into to Kara, Leviticus, and God introduces Pesach, it's like one sentence. You know, on the 14th day of the first month, there is Passover to approach Yahweh. Next subject, we move on to unyeasted bread. Why does he do that? Because he goes into intimate detail about exactly how we go about celebrating Pesach during the Exodus. And so you want to read about Pesach. You read about Pesach in
this
Shemot names.
Story.
Yeah, that's where the story of Pesach is detailed. And so that's part of what we're doing here is we're really going to the roots of it and finding out how God details it. And then once he has done so, then we cover every other reference that he has to Pesach so that we understand it from every possible perspective. But the single most important perspective is how Pesach became the door to life and how that door to life has to be. And God is really implicit about this and explicit about it, which he says, do not even think of participating in Pesach unless you're also committed to Matzah.
Yeah. No joke.
Yeah, powerful. So Pesach and Matzah are the same event. They begin on the same night. Yes. So your last thing you want to be is immortal and imperfect because there's only one
place to go.
Well, that's Sheol. Well, there's a place to go, but it's not
a Sheol. Oh, yeah, that's what I'm
right.
saying. There's no
right.
place to go.
So,
but down.
Yeah. And being perfect but immortal doesn't do any good because our mortal lives are really short. We need both, and that is his constant explanation to us as to why it is, what it is that I'm freeing you from, how I'm liberating you from this, and how you're going to go about celebrating it, and really interesting details about even things about Abib, for example, what Abib means, and how we can identify the first month of the year. We're left with all the information we know to make an informed and rational decision about Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, and Shavuot. And that's really what we're going to be talking about here for the foreseeable future.
Good.
All right, fellas. Always good to have you here. It's always funny to hear people are saying around the world. And these are amazing times. Who would have ever thought the world would have changed as radically as it has? But that's a good thing because a lot of people now are receptive to the notion that we're
Let's
in the last days. Yeah, it's time to wake up. And
yes, sir.
And one of the great awakenings here was we've always known that Israel is not going to be the victim of a nuclear attack. And we always know that Iran would nuke Israel given the chance. And the Israelis pulled off another major coup. They blew up the power source and the backup power source to the centrifuges at the Natanz refinery. And so for the next 9 months, nothing works. The centrifuges all blew up when they had no power. They just spun out of control. And so it'll be 9 months of, and the Israelis will probably do the same thing again because the Iranians don't seem to figure it out. The last two times, they have smuggled explosives with a remote detonator into the furniture. So the Iranians keep on ordering furniture for the offices, their refineries, and power plants.
Furniture.
Oh, we need
Israel.
Furniture. Yeah.
Come on,
okay.
I'm
going to
put that desk there.
Yeah, another order of that furniture. That guy on Iranians want another batch. Well,
express shipment.
Express shipment, yes. Not with our compliments here.
Big discount.
Have a deal. We have a deal for you. Free gift with purchase.
I didn't know that.
Detonator.
We're given 90 days to pay.
You got to love the ingenuity of Jews. That's one of the things. I mean, Israeli politics is just perplexing to me. It's actually disgusting to me. But one of the things about Benjamin Netanyahu is that he says, on my watch, the Iranians are not going to get a nuclear bomb. And, he's been pretty brazen about taking out their nuclear scientists and disabling their centrifuges and disabling their power and doing things I don't think America could do.
No.
But, then again, America's doing stuff they can't do, like putting tracking devices into viruses. So everybody's got to have their set.
They're busy.
Now the show will be bad because no one was knowing that I was being sarcastic. Being sarcastic. They really aren't doing that. All right. You all have a wonderful show. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you. We look forward to being with you next week. We'll continue to pursue the road to Pesach. I was doorway to life and the entrance to heaven. May y'all bless you all. Good night.
Sounds good.
Shalom.
Bye.